We shall hear today Charles W. Ferris, CSB, member of the Board of Lectureship of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientists in Boston, Massachusetts, speaking on the subject, Who's in Control?
Thank you very much, Mr. Cadell, and good evening. As I came into the Veterans War Memorial Auditorium this noon to check over some things, I couldn't help but be caught by that stirring painting by Howard Chandler Christie out in the front entrance there, depicting the signing of the United Nations Charter back in 1945. At that time, these men were seeking and some ideals which they could submit to and which would result in a sense of control and peace for all. Well, their search at that time isn't so much different from the search that we're conducting this evening, because we too are going to consider some basic ideals which form the real foundation for control. And this control applies not only in the areas of international and national situations, but in business, in human relations, in our health, in fact, in all the various areas of our experience. And in order to throw some light onto how we can gain this control, I'd like to start out by asking you a question. Would you rather be a leader or a follower? Since most of us like to feel that we're in the driver's seat, that we make our own decisions, you'd probably answer that you'd rather be a leader. We all like to feel that we're on top of our circumstances instead of circumstances being on top of us. Speaking of being a leader, some years ago, I came home all enthusiastic about a friend of mine who'd just been made a vice president in his company. And I said jokingly to my wife, "Gee, I'd like to be a vice president." And she looked at me and she said, "You are, you are." Meaning, of course, that she was the president. But getting back to this question, would you rather be a leader or a follower? I gained an interesting perspective on this from an answer a high school girl gave in a Christian Science Sunday school class. The students had all been asked this same question: would you rather be a leader or a follower? And most of them said, a leader. They felt a leader gives orders instead of being told what to do. But this girl had a different view. She said, "I'd like to be a leader and a follower, and both at the same time." She explained that if you're a leader, you have a responsibility to the people you lead. You want to feel you're leading them right. And you can't do this unless you have some rule or guide to follow. So, in order to be a good leader, you also have to be a good follower. There's a story in the Bible that makes a similar point. It's about a Roman centurion. I'm sure that most of you here this evening are familiar with this story. This Roman officer had a servant who was sick, apparently near death, and he came to Jesus for help. Jesus said he would come and heal the man, but the officer objected. "Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed." Why did this Roman officer feel that Jesus had such power? Well, he must have known of the wonderful healing works of Jesus, but his next remark showed a deeper insight into these works, because he drew a parallel between himself as a soldier and Jesus. He said, "For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say to one, go, and he goeth. And to another, come, and he cometh. And to my servant, do this, and he doeth it." The Bible says that when Jesus heard it, he marveled. And he said to them that followed, "Verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel." The centurion returned home, and he found his servant healed. Now, what had this Roman officer seen? He'd seen that Jesus gave orders to disease, just as he gave orders to his men. But he also saw that just as he drew his power from his superior officers and eventually from the emperor himself, so Jesus drew his power from a superior and ultimate authority. Both the high school girl and the centurion saw, in their own different ways, that we can exercise authority only as we obey authority. What authority did Jesus obey that gave him such control over adverse circumstances of every kind? The answer to this question is given by Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, in her book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. Here she writes, "Divine truth, life, and love gave Jesus authority over sin, sickness, and death. Jesus exercised authority or control at all times because at all times he submitted to the divine truth, life, and love, which he recognized as the supreme governing authority in the universe and as the heavenly father of men, God." Now, of course, Jesus' experience was unique, but it serves as a model for each one of us. Like the high school girl and the centurion, we all must learn that we gain mastery over our circumstances only as we submit to a higher authority. Jesus gave the supreme expression of this when he said, "Father, not my will, but thine be done." And this brings us to the main point, that we can take control of our experience only as we submit to the control of God. In the degree that we obey God's will, in that degree we can make our own independent contribution to life, in our relations with others, in our work, and in facing such difficulties as accident or ill health. This evening, I'd like to explore an actual situation from each of these three areas, and then use these situations as the basis for our seeing together just what it means to obey God's will. Also, what it is that would make us disobey God's will and so separate us from this source of power. And then we'll see some of the ways that obedience to God's will enables us to be on top of our circumstances instead of letting circumstances be on top of us. So let's turn to these three areas: our human relations, our work, and our health. When our human relations are disturbed, when others act in an unfriendly or uncooperative way, we can feel upset and frustrated. And this was dramatically illustrated for me early one evening. My wife and I had been shopping, and we thought we'd treat ourselves to dinner at a fine restaurant downtown. Everything was perfect, except the waiter. He was clearly in a bad mood, and he plunked down our menus belligerently without a word. Well, I figured this mood would pass. We ordered. When he brought the first course, I tried to strike up a conversation with him, but he just wouldn't answer. He came to clear away the first course, and again I tried to be just as friendly as I could. But no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't draw a friendly response from this man. It appeared that our pleasant evening would be marred by his hostile, unfriendly attitude, and apparently we couldn't do a thing about it. Now, this may seem like a small incident, but when it's multiplied by all the times that people are unfriendly, uncooperative, and even as this man was, out and out hostile, It constitutes a very important area where we like to feel equal to the situation. Before we consider how I solve this human relationship problem, though, let's consider the second area where we like to determine our experience, our work. Aren't we inclined to feel helpless if something happens to affect our job? I'm sure that most of us here are familiar with this feeling, but a friend of mine experienced it in a particularly severe way. He'd taken a job with a well-established Eastern manufacturing company. It was an excellent opportunity, and he'd made the most of it. After only 6 years, he'd become an officer in the company. He was well known and he was respected in the community. And he and his family had moved into a new home. Their first house wasn't sold yet. In fact, it had been on the market for 14 months. But he was able to handle this financially. And then one afternoon, the president of the company called him in and told him without warning of any kind that his services would no longer be required. He was through. He got himself to an employment agency right away. But they told him that because of the high level of his position and the specialized work and salary demands, it would probably take about 6 months to find a place for him. Yet, if he didn't find something almost immediately, he could be in serious financial difficulty. He'd used his bank reserve in buying the second house. And if he couldn't keep up the payments, he stood a chance of losing both of the houses. To all appearances, he was in a situation that was out of control, leaving him with a temporarily helpless and frustrated feeling. Now, again, before we consider how he solved this business problem, let's look to the third area where we need to be on top of things, our health. Doesn't it disturb us when our health fails? Or when someone dear to us is threatened by accident or ill health? A young mother, who is a close friend of my wife and myself, faced such a situation. Her little boy was hit by a car as he darted across the busy street in front of their house. A crowd gathered quickly. The boy had all the evidence of a severe concussion, and because of deep cuts, his head was bleeding profusely. The father was out of town, so the mother had this challenge to face alone. Here was a situation which she seemed unable to do much about. Now, I've given you three examples where circumstances seem to take the experience of several people out of their hands. What could they do? What can any of us do when we're frustrated or afraid? Actually, there's only one thing we can do. Come to understand what really governs our experience. The high school girl pointed to the answer when she said, "If you want to be a good leader, you have to be a good follower." In other words, if you want to exercise authority, you have to submit to authority. The centurion showed us this too. He drew a parallel between the authority he expressed because he submitted to his military superiors and the authority Jesus expressed because he submitted to God. Jesus did submit wholeheartedly to God. He said so himself. "I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father which hath sent me." And this same divine authority that Jesus expressed in unparalleled measure is available to us when we submit to God's will as he did. But in order to submit to God's will, we need to understand what God's will is. Here are three things we can say about God's will. First, it's always good. Second, it's universal. That is, it applies to everyone. Third, it's always expressed. It's never abstract. It's concrete. We experience it directly. We can say say these things about God's will because of what he is. You know, it stands to reason that God's will or purpose is going to be in line with his nature. For instance, if we take one of the names for God, say the descriptive term mind, which is used for God in Christian Science and is also implied in the Bible, we see that God's will must be always good. And here's why. God, as mind, is the intelligent source of all right ideas. He's the creator, the father, the origin. We could even say the author, from which we get our word authority. Now, if we accept God as intelligent mind, we have to conclude that his ideas are always constructive and progressive. They're never destructive or unwise. So, God's will, as characterized by intelligent ideas, must be always constructive, always good. The same reasoning applies to all the other descriptive terms for God, and it gives further proof that God's will must be always good. Take these names for God found in the Bible. Love, life, spirit, I am. Love indicates affection and care. Life excludes death. Spirit excludes limitation. I am brings to our thought full and satisfying individuality. All of these point to the intent of God's will as being entirely good for man. Wasn't the goodness of God's will seen in the centurion's contact with Jesus? Jesus didn't say, "I'm sorry your servant is sick," but it must be God's will. He said, "I will come and heal him." Jesus understood that God never ordains sickness or suffering. Then, in addition to understanding that God is good, preserves our health, we can also know that his will includes supply for every need. The infinite mind and unceasing love, which are God, could do no less than impart to us every necessary idea and quality. The Epistle of James affirms this. "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning." There's no limit to God's giving, and there's no interruption in God's giving. Every good gift. No variableness. So, first we can identify God's will as being entirely good. Second, God's will is universal. It's everywhere present and applies to each individual. It has to apply to each individual, since nothing exists except that which is the fulfillment of God's purpose. Christ Jesus illustrated the universality of God's will in his parable about a man with 100 sheep. You remember he said, "If he loses one, will he not leave the 99 and go out and seek that one which is lost?" And he concluded, "Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." Each individual is precious to God. No one is excluded from God's purpose for man. No one here this evening is excluded from God's good will. No one on this planet, no one in the entire universe is excluded from the goodness which is God. And then the third point about God's will, it's always expressed. It's never abstract. It's never withheld from us. Mary Baker Eddy brought out this vital point when she emphasized that not only is God totally good as creator or basic cause, but he's always expressing himself in a good creation. Well, this creation is man, is you and me in our true spiritual nature. Even as a child, Mrs. Eddy couldn't accept the traditional religious teaching of her day of foreordination, that God willed some men to be saved and willed others to be condemned. To her, God being wholly good, he had to have a wholly good creation. This conviction was a forerunner to her discovery of Christian Science in 1866. At this time, she realized that as each of us understands what God's nature really is and identifies himself in thought and conduct as the expression of God, the sorrows and the suffering of human experience have to be seen as unreal and disappear, because they're not the expression of a good God. For nearly 10 years after her discovery, Mrs. Eddy successfully applied this truth to the healing of all kinds of human ills. Then, in 1875, she published Science and Health to explain her discovery. In the teaching of this book, Mrs. Eddy set aside the false concept of God and man as separate from one another and as having separate wills. She showed that man is distinct from God, as effect is distinct from cause, but that man is not separate from God. He actively expresses God's will of universal good. Let me illustrate that. When you are kind, in a degree you're expressing love, that is, God. Or when you behave intelligently, in a degree you're expressing mind, that is, God. Now, this doesn't mean that you are love or mind or God. You are the expression of love, mind, God. But at the same time, you're not separated from these. You're at one with the divine source of your being. When we see this, it makes us want to accept God's will, because we see that God could never impose on us or restrict us. His purpose is to empower us, to benefit us, liberate us, and to supply us with all that goes to make up our full and satisfying selfhood. I came to feel this power and presence of God's will one time in an unforgettable way. I just moved to a large city where I knew no one when I arrived. Actually, I guess I'd been there about a year. One evening, I found myself sitting in my room feeling depressed and lonely. It wasn't that I hadn't formed some wonderful friendships, but somehow this didn't seem the same as having someone I could share my life and share my work with. Also, my finances were extremely low. Well, I've been a student of Christian Science all my life, and as I sat there seeking an answer, all of a sudden the significance of what I'd studied swept over me. I saw that I could never have more than I had right at that moment. Now, this may sound like a peculiar thing to say, that I could never have more than I had right at that moment. And it may not sound very encouraging, seeing I was alone and almost broke. But I'd realized what the verse from the Bible means that says, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. In other words, I said to myself, If tomorrow I should have an unlimited income, according to material evidence, and if I should find myself with perfect, ideal, satisfying companionship, I wouldn't have any more than I have right now. I've caught a glimpse of God's will as unlimited, abundant good, universally expressed. The material evidence didn't tell me this, but my spiritual understanding told me, and the feelings of lack and loneliness disappeared. Well, the next day I didn't have any more money in the bank, and no one had fallen in love with me. But a change had occurred within me. I won't say I was never tempted again to feel lonely or financially frustrated. But whenever this temptation would come, I returned to that glimpse I'd caught of God's will as always ensuring an unlimited abundance of good, and I'd be at peace. The financial picture and the companionship picture didn't change immediately, but I still felt this peace. And this was one of the most beautiful parts of the entire experience, because it meant that after both situations had changed for the better, I was still able to base my freedom from lack and loneliness not on the material evidence, but on spiritual understanding. Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. I'd been seeing God's will of unlimited good in place of the material evidence that seemed to contradict God's will. And this opened the way for me to experience more and more good in my life. So, to sum up, we can describe God's will in three words. It's good, universally expressed. And as we accept this divine will, we find that we gain control over our experience because we're submitting and aligning ourselves with the unlimited power and substance that are God. Now, when we come to see that God has only good in store for us, it would seem we'd be only too eager to align ourselves with His will. One of the main difficulties in doing this is that we sometimes confuse God's will with human will. And human will is something that we all have to come to terms with. Even Mrs. Eddy had to. She was born in New Hampshire, and she came from a family that had some strong-willed members, and she grew up among strong-willed neighbors. But from early in her life, she had a definite sense of divinely appointed mission. After her discovery of Christian Science, she knew clearly what this mission was: to make available to all mankind this practical healing and saving truth. She faced obstacles and opposition that would have discouraged someone less determined. But she continued to demonstrate her discovery, to teach it to students, to write her book, Science and Health, and to found the Christian Science Church with all of its auxiliary activities. What gave her the strength and the determination for all of this? It was a readiness to be guided by God, to do His will, and to set aside her own human will. Many times she set out on some course only to find it wasn't in accord with God's purpose. And then she would withdraw, and she would wait for God to show her His way of doing what was needed. But when she was sure she was acting in obedience to God's will, she held to her course regardless of the difficulties, and she won through to her objectives. Now, when we feel that we're at the mercy of circumstances, it's because we're following a course apart from God. We're permitting human will to operate. So in order really to be on top of our experience, we also have to realize when human will is operating. And to do this, we need to know what human will is. The first characteristic of human will was seen in the experience of the young mother whose 5-year-old boy was hit by the car. What tried to make her afraid? It certainly appeared that God's good will for man wasn't operating. But what told her this? Wasn't it the conclusions she drew from the material evidence? The boy's physical appearance, the crowd of people, the anxiety of the woman who'd been driving the car. Wasn't this the evidence that tried to persuade her there was a moment when God's will wasn't operating? This is the first characteristic of human will, drawing conclusions from material evidence. Then a second characteristic of human will was illustrated by the businessman. When he felt that he was no longer master of his employment situation, wasn't it because his own plans for the future had suddenly been interfered with? When this situation went contrary to his plan, wasn't this why he felt he'd lost control? The discouraging prediction of the employment service added to this feeling. Here, we see a second characteristic of human will, outlining exactly how we feel a situation should work out, or how we fear a situation may work out. This certainly doesn't mean we shouldn't plan. But if we think a situation can be solved only in the particular way we outline, this is human will operating. It isn't receptivity to the divine will. And then a third characteristic of human will is self-interest, putting one's own interest and advantage above regard for others. In my experience with the waiter, wasn't I thinking of myself when I felt disappointed and frustrated because our pleasant dinner would be marred by this man's unfriendly, hostile attitude? You know, a concern for one's own selfish interest is a strong facet of human will because it tends to blind us to the universality of God's will as providing good for all in unlimited measure. Human will, then, can be identified by these three characteristics: drawing conclusions from material evidence, insistence on our own plans, and concern for ourselves without regard for others. How do we let go of human will and submit to God's will instead? We do it mentally and spiritually. We decide we're going to accept only the evidence of God's will instead of the testimony of human will. Isn't this what Jesus did when the centurion came seeking help for his servant? When Jesus heard that the centurion's servant was sick, did he agree with this? No. He held to God's will as good, universally expressed. He mentally replaced the material evidence presented by the centurion with spiritual evidence. Here, Jesus conformed to the prediction about the Messiah given by the prophet Isaiah 600 years earlier. Isaiah had written, "He shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears." Because Jesus fulfilled this prophecy, we refer to him as the Messiah, or to use the Greek version, the Christ. His complete identification with the Christ, bringing the true sense of God and man, gave him his healing power. The change of thought that Jesus taught and the Christian Science now teaches is the rejection of a false limited view of man, and the acceptance instead of man as God's expression. It's not a change from one material form of thinking to a different material form of thinking. In other words, Jesus didn't decide that the centurion's servant should become well. His perfection was already included in the will of God, of the divine mind that has conceived and created each one of us. Jesus simply understood God's will for man, and his acceptance of this divine will healed the centurion's servant. The Bible states that the healing took place at exactly the time Jesus spoke. There was no period of recuperation because, in reality, no actual change took place. God's will is established. It's unchanging. Now, we may seem to require a period of time to let go of our material conceptions, rigid planning, self-interest. But the instant we do let go of these and submit to God's will, the healing is accomplished. The healing is the acceptance of the good that has always existed. This may sound easy. It should be. But I'm sure that each of us has found that at times it seems very difficult to let go of human will. What do we do at such a time? We pray. We acknowledge the truth of God's will operating as the law of life and health. And we gain help in our prayer by studying the spiritual truth found in the Bible and in Christian Science. And if necessary, we can call on another to help us, as the centurion called on Jesus. Through these efforts, we can reach the point where we let go of human will and submit to God's will instead. As we do so, we find that we gain authority over our experience to the benefit of all. How is this universal benefit expressed? Let's answer this question by returning now to the three incidents we discussed earlier and see how the solution was found in each instance through yielding to the will of God. Do you remember the matter of human relationships in the restaurant? I felt that my wife and I were going to have our pleasant evening spoiled because of the waiter's unfriendly, hostile attitude. Well, I finally got to the point where I was just going to ignore him and not let his attitude interfere with the pleasantness of our evening. But I couldn't be content with this approach. And there was something about shutting out my fellow man that wouldn't let me rest. As I considered the problem, I saw the waiter standing by the kitchen waiting for our meal. He was a Negro, and the race riots in Watts were currently drawing much attention. As I watched him, my heart went out to him. I sensed the challenge that he faced. Suddenly, my resentment and my disappointment drained away. I had let go of that element of human will we call self-interest. But I had to do more than this. I had to stop drawing conclusions from material evidence as well. According to material evidence, the prevailing social conditions limited this man's progress in many ways. But I needed to know that in place of this material view, God's will was operating. I needed to know that, in reality, God imparts his qualities to each individual without measure, and nothing can prevent the full expression of these qualities. To the degree that this truth is realized, limitation of whatever nature can be set aside. Well, by the time the waiter came back to our table, it wouldn't have mattered what attitude he had. I had let go of human will and had submitted to God's will instead, acknowledging good universally expressed. But the man's attitude had completely changed. As he prepared the skewered beef we'd ordered, he talked freely, animatedly with us. You can't imagine a more friendly atmosphere. When we were finished, he helped my wife on with her coat, and then he came over to me and he did something that no waiter had ever done before. He took my hand in both of his and he shook hands with me, and he looked me right in the eye and he said, "I'm awfully glad you came." All my human efforts had failed, but realizing the will of God established warmth and friendliness. Had I gained control over this man? No. I had accepted God's will, with the result that God controlled the entire situation. Now, by admitting the power of God, we not only solve problems of human relationships, but we also bring our activities, particularly employment, under the divine control. Now, this is certainly what my friend needed when he lost his good-paying, secure position. He saw that he needed to let go of human will and submit to God's will, acknowledging God as alone controlling him. So first, he rejected this forecast that finding an equivalent job could possibly take several months. Instead, he realized that as universal good, God's will is always expressed. The intelligent mind, God, who gives man his ideas and his abilities, also provides a continuing demand for them. But he not only gave up the outlining of possible delay, he also replaced his own personal interest and bitterness with a deep desire to be of service. His anxiety and his frustration left, and he gained that sense of freedom that only complete submission to God's will can bring. Within 1 week, a much larger firm contacted him. They made a similar product, and they were in serious need of someone to head up their research and engineering department. And this was precisely his area of specialization. The new position paid better. The location offered his family more cultural and civic activities, and he sold both of the houses quickly without suffering any loss. A mutual friend of ours said to him later, "Bill, losing that other job was the best thing that could have happened to you." By completely giving up his fears and a limited view of his future, the good which God wills was expressed in his experience. Then we spoke of how submitting to God's will brings our health under the divine control. When my little 5-year-old friend was hit by the car, his mother immediately telephoned a Christian Science practitioner for help. He heard the stress and the anxiety in her voice, and he said to her, "We need to know that no accident has occurred." Now, to some here this evening, this may sound strange. It was certainly a radical statement, but it accorded perfectly with the nature of God's will as good, universally expressed. You see, it was necessary under the circumstances to challenge and to silence the testimony of human will with its conclusions from material evidence and its outlining or mental projection of harmful results. Since the mother wanted to rely entirely on Christian Science, the practitioner told her to bring the boy into the house and he would help through prayer and Christian Science. After a few moments, she called back, and she asked if he would come personally to the house, since there seemed to be so much fear surrounding this situation. When he arrived about 15 minutes later, the boy's condition had already improved considerably. The profuse bleeding had completely stopped, although there were still serious symptoms of the concussion. The little family, the mother, the 8 and 10-year-old brother and sister, the practitioner and his wife, went into the living room, and they turned to quiet prayer. Through studying the Bible and Science and Health, they worked to realize God's will and to set aside their own human will. They knew there was no power in conclusions from material evidence or in a mental projection of anything opposite to God's will. The mother's decision not to subject the boy to a physical examination. There'd been a lot of pressure along this line. This decision also was significant. It showed her desire to reject the conclusions from material evidence and human opinion, and to rely instead entirely upon God, to learn from spiritual understanding what the real and perfect condition of her son was. Later, she checked in the bedroom, and she found that the boy was sleeping quietly. In the morning, he awoke clear in his thinking. Every evidence of the concussion had disappeared. He ate some breakfast, and by afternoon, he was playing quietly around the house. The next day, he attended his half-day in nursery school, and by the end of the week, he was outside playing normally and vigorously. The deep cuts healed up quickly. No stitches were taken. By letting go of every trace of human will, a sure sense of control was felt over this situation from beginning to end. The divine control that comes from submitting entirely to God's will. Good, universally expressed. This evening I referred to several specific instances of what happens when we bring our lives under the divine control. Any of us who has had such an experience is profoundly grateful for this evidence of the real source of authority. But when we know that we've gained authority by submitting to God's will, a deeper feeling moves us than gratitude for mere relief from human difficulties. This deeper feeling is the assurance that the power of God exists and that it is supreme over all material conditions. As we accept this divine power, we find that it gives us, in turn, authority over every kind of daily experience. And then we really know who's in control. Good evening.
This has been another Christian Science lecture on KBRG. Charles W. Ferris, CSB, has spoken to us on the subject, Who's in Control?